Oh, Mafia Stare Down. Very good, Michael. We're here to negotiate. Do you have anything else you might like?
I want a flying pony.
Yeah, I want a flying pony too, but they don't exist.
Then I want a regular pony. And I want to name him Nelson.
How about a PlayStation 3? We name him Nelson.
Keep talking.
We'll include 4 video games.
5 games. And I want the meeting with Blondie to be at J.D. McFunnigan's.
How about Charlie Choo Choo's, because it's right down the street from me.
You mention that slop hole again and I walk.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, a podcast cultivating a unique roadmap through the films comprising the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my curator companion, Sejan Sarawik. Sejan?
Yes, I'm sorry, I do need to apologize. I bit my tongue, something just occurred that... I had to hold back on something there, but yes, Devin, we're here. We're on the other side, Devin. We're going into the unknown, and I'm scared. I have to tell you,
I am scared too. I thought I was the only one. I'm sitting here like freaking. And am I the only Melissa Etheridge? Is that who sings that song?
No, Melissa McCarthy, right?
No. In some universe, I'm certain that it is Melissa McCarthy, and Melissa Etheridge starred against Billy Gardell and Mike and Molly, and that would be interesting, too, to see an overweight cop try to fall in love with a middle-aged lesbian. Hi. Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm Devin Decker.
Is that a Sandler movie yet? I feel like Kevin James was in that movie, wasn't he? yeah, hey, and I'm Sejan Sarawik.
And we are. We're on the other side, because when we started this, we had 6 movies that we knew, slam dunk, these films exist in a shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
And then Devin decided that for our very first movie outside of that, we were going to have a knockdown, brawl-out fight with this one instead about whether or not it belonged.
Yeah, I wanted to be in the parking lot of a Chuck E. Cheese ripoff and throw a cup of soda in your face and see what you had to say about it, Sejan.
It's slow-mo. What was
that? Well, I don't... There's a lot.
And those kids had no idea that was going to happen. That is perhaps the best part of that particular scene, is watching the look on the face of the two child actors in this movie so fucking delighted, because there's no way the two of them knew that that was what was about to happen in front of them.
I suppose they did that to see if they could... Just go with it.
Boom. There it is, folks. All We're doing Just Go With It. The Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston team up. There's a lot going on here we got to talk
there's
about.
There's a lot going on.
I'm so thrown off. How do we do this show?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, it's been a while because, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to season 2 of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And just a couple of little, like, housekeeping headline things. Now that we've gone through the first 6 films in our first season, which, as a reminder, was Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy, Little Nicky, Pixels, and Hubie Halloween, we now have an established, like, list of criteria to be a film within this shared cinematic universe.
And a pretty soft rule. I mean, I only say soft because there's no reason for us to ever truly enforce it unless something crazy happens. But like, an understanding that those 6 movies definitively are in what we consider to be a shared universe, correct? Like, there's no question here. We're walking away from that with that decision made.
Right. At this point, those movies have been established to be sort of the gospel of the ASCU.
But as we say, this is me and your opinion.
Yeah.
And the ASCU is of our creation. So we're not saying anybody out there that disagrees with us is not allowed in the room. Like, in fact, I definitely would love to hear from anybody that has issues with that. But as far as you and I are concerned, going forward with these conversations, we are on the same page about that being the universe that we are starting from.
Yeah, those are the 6 movies that we're going to sort of be seeing if the films we're watching in season 2 slot in and fit without causing, like, you know, any breaks in the space-time continuum of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And it should be fun. We have a theme, too, right? We didn't really have a theme for the first season, but I like to consider season two Adam and. And it's not about stripping. It's not being a goody-good, goody-good, goody-goody-two-shoes. It is about Adam and another leading actor in that film. He's right. Sort of sharing the spotlight in these films. And if that's where you're going to go, sort of the easiest jumping off point are all of the romantic comedies that Adam Sandler did with Drew Barrymore and Jennifer Aniston. Specifically, those are the ones that we're going to start at looking at. And then we're going to have some fun and exciting things later on, but we'll save that until later in the season to reveal to you.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons that we want to do that is there is some connective tissue, the same way that you have that connective tissue between Happy Gilmore and Hubie Halloween. My father, when I told him what our theme was going to be for season two, he jumped up out of his chair. He was so excited to be like, Julie Bowen, you can do Julie Bowen. And it's like, well, we already did Julie Bowen. But Dad, because we did Julie Bowen, that's how we can jump off into Adam and Jennifer Aniston and Adam and Drew Barrymore.
Right. I mean, it was no, you know, essentially Sandler is no, you know, newbie when it comes to the idea of sharing the screen. We've talked many a time about how important it is for him to have an ensemble around him that can support him. And sometimes when that ensemble is not strong enough, like we see in some of the movies in the past, some things kind of start some cracks start to show, right? So it's when he has a really strong ensemble around him, a really strong couple of partners he can lean on for stuff, when Sandler really is at his best. So the idea of him having a secondary lead is not strange. It's just that when we established the universe, we realized that it was important for us to focus on Sandler-specific films, right? And now we're starting to we've always known this, but we're starting to branch out into some Sandler-esque films. And I think this is where we're going to have some really interesting conversations today, Dev, because I'm sorry for riding your ass about establishing the stuff for the from the made universe in the first six episodes, but in the first season, as it were. But I have some strong feelings about how I feel like this movie is not going to work. And in fact, I see it as not a parallel universe, but a perpendicular one. It crosses right through the Sandler universe as we know it, picks up some shit along the way, but I think it kind of then plows on through into something else. Because I think that we're going to talk about some things here that are definitely in this movie that Sandler brings to the table. But I think at the end of the day, for me, we're gonna have to massage some rough edges here if you're gonna convince me that this movie fits.
Honestly, my initial theory going into these films is that if anything, they're going to be weird little pocket dimensions within the Adam Sandler cinematic universe that definitely borrow from established, you know, physics, chemistry, biology of the universe, but would be difficult to, you know, show up and party with Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore and Bobby Boucher.
I think I'd feel much better about this Sandler being somewhat in the universe with the others if he showed up with like an evil goatee on, right? like I'd be like, okay, all right, he's from another universe, but he's visiting ours, like, and he's here, and he's here to cause trouble. Like that is the feelings I have about this movie as a whole. This is the crappy evil Spock version that's shown up. But let's talk about it. So first impressions, right? Like that's clearly where we're at right now. Let's just lay them on the table. And you know, mine are what they are. Like I have some pretty broad general issues with this movie as a movie before we even get into like the Sandler stuff, and we'll talk about those a little bit once you've kind of laid the law down on what this movie is. But bringing in the idea that we are viewing it through the lens of the cinematic universe, the Sandler cinematic universe, it gets even worse. I don't know if I want to kind of throw all my cards down on the table or not, but like, here we go. I feel like this movie's biggest issue personally for me is that it is actually two distinct films. There is a movie that is played out and set up for the first, honestly, hour. It is a good, hard middle cut where then suddenly a major event occurs and it becomes a completely different movie for the second half of it. And I think the first movie I'd be much more comfortable talking about in the sense of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. And the second movie is Adam Sandler starring in a French farce. And we'll talk more about that as we go. But where are you at with this movie? I gotta hear the words from your mouth.
All right. So first impression after watching Just Go With It, a film that I, up to this point, had not seen. This was my very first time watching the film.
I think I watched it on a plane once, but I will throw myself into that lot with you. I don't think I ever paid attention whenever this movie was on around me. Let me put it on that way.
The first words out of my mouth and the first thing that I wrote in my notes and the final thoughts that I wrote in my notes the first time I watched this film is, Just Go With It is a legitimate movie.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
okay.
And that right there, when we're talking about a word like legitimate, what do I mean? What do I mean when I say it's a legitimate movie?
Yes, and... Professor, what do you mean? you brought it to the table.
I know that. I understand that. But, like, I then had to sit with that and it's like, well, what does that mean? If your first reaction, Devin, is this is a legitimate film, why? What is it? What does that mean? And what I think I'm saying is the other films that we have looked at in this series so far, as part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, not to cast aspersions on them, not to say that they're not legitimate films, but they are very much Adam Sandler films. They are very much films that are created with his voice in the room, in the creation process. He is on the set with directors that he knows. There's contributions from Adam. It's like a living thing that Adam Sandler is part of. But in this film, in Just Go With It, it feels like he really took a back seat to what else was going on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's where I'm like, well, this is a legitimate film because it's not just Adam Sandler hanging out with his friends. It's Adam Sandler acting. And honestly, that's not what I was expecting from Just Go With It, based on everything that I had heard about the film. And we'll go into deeper detail as what I mean with that also when we get a little deeper into the episode.
Yeah, I want to just jump in now before angry tweets happen. Like we have talked before about how Sandler, more than we ever realized until we started doing this show, has always really put the work in to do the, I mean, like, to really break it down. Like, he has done the character work, right? Like, he has gone back and he has done his questions, his five questions, like, who am I? What do I want in this scene? What is my tactics? Like, that, you know, like, he has dug into it more than we, I think, ever truly gave him credit for as a people, and more than we ever realized. It's not that he was not doing this kind of work before. It's that I think what it is this time is the work that he is doing is much more grounded in what we understand to be real. Whereas before it has always been, here is the character that I want to end up with. What can I do to justify that character work? This one very much started with, okay, what are my details? Here's the character that comes from it. And yeah, like you said, we'll talk more about it because I think what I need right now more than anything is a breakdown of what this movie is all about.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing about this movie is until you know the players, it's going to be hard to understand the game. So, let me just take one more sip of water before this synopsis. Just Go With It tells the tragic tale of Dr. Daniel Maccabee, who had his heart broken in 1988 on his wedding day. Luckily, fate smiled upon him when that same day, boozing away his sorrows at a singles bar, and for some inexplicable reason wearing a wedding band, he learned the true magic of being a man off the market. Over the course of the next 23 years, the sweet and considerate Danny, corrupted by the power of the one wedding ring, becomes a real ladies' man, since in addition to somehow making him irresistible to women, it also inoculates him from ever having his heart broken again. Then one night, after removing his precious to help a wounded child, he meets Palmer, Brooklyn Decker, and after spending a wonderful night together, he actually connects with a woman for the first time, possibly in his entire life, and is ready to risk the pain of heartache again, which would have gone fine if not for the fact that she finds the wedding ring in his pants the next morning. Unable to get him out of his mind, and convinced he can't tell her the truth without sounding like a pig by his assistant Catherine Murphy, Jennifer Aniston, the obvious course of action is to keep on lying. With Catherine's help, Danny cooks up a story that he is in the midst of divorce proceedings. Unfortunately, being a child of divorce, Palmer insists on meeting Danny's fictional future ex-wife to confirm his story, and since this was Catherine's idea, she is conscripted to play the role of Mrs. Maccabee. Despite the underlying hostility on display between Danny and Catherine, the meeting goes better than expected, but a poorly timed call from Catherine's children right before the curtain falls convinces Palmer that in addition to a wife, Danny also has two children, Kiki D and Bardo. Thus, the next logical step is to have Catherine's children, Maggie and Michael, act as these children in order to continue the ruse. However, when forced by Maggie to yes and, Michael's claim that Danny broke his promise to take him to Hawaii to swim with the dolphins because he started dating Palmer, the entire group is forced to just go with it, all the way to the 50th state. Somehow matters are complicated even further when Catherine's friend from college, Devlin Adams, Nicole Kidman, is also staying at the same resort with her husband, an inventor of the iPod, Ian Maxtone Jones, Dave Matthews, forcing Catherine to just go with it and further continue the lie that Danny is her husband to save face in front of her frenemy. As this web of lies becomes thicker and more complex with every breath they take, emotions strengthen and truths are revealed. But who will it be that Danny marries at the end of this farce? The woman who made him want to look for love again, or the one there all along in his blind spot?
All right, man. I am going to do something I've never done before. First of all, I'm going to do something I always do, and that's congratulate you on a phenomenal thing. But I'm also going to call out a pretty gaping hole, and maybe I just missed it. Where the fuck is Eddie?
Eddie doesn't matter to me in this synopsis. I'm so sorry.
No. It's interesting that you say that. I am not upset by you saying that, because in order for me to be upset, I would have to give a shit about Eddie myself.
Eddie is the most Adam Sandler feeling thing in this film.
Okay. Yes. I agree with that. But we have to get into my feelings about the two movies, because you mentioned something earlier. This is just too many strings that are all coming together into a knot. I got to untie them now. The idea that you said that this feels like a project that Sandler came to, as opposed to was there for the creation of, which is what all the other projects, right? And that's a huge knock against it for me as far as it being in the verse, right? But the other thing that I want to kind of talk about a little bit here, and this is we're getting into the alleged realm. I don't have much as far as like the background stuff goes, and I will get to that because I know that that's in the formula for the show. But I will get to that in a moment. But I want to get this out now. I feel like this movie was a script that had been sitting around, possibly like a blacklist script or something. We know from the credits and a bit of research that this is a movie that is actually based on an older movie, which was based on a Broadway play, which in and of itself was based on a French farce. So like, this is so far removed from a Sandler creation, but I really feel like that's really the back half movie. That is that it's really the front half movie where honestly, I think it's the better Sandler film. And I think that's really where you see a lot more of Sandler and his crew putting the work in to actually build some like world, right? And so I think that it's interesting that you say that Eddie really feels like he's so out of place, because I think that Eddie in the first half doesn't feel so out of place for a Sandler film, feels like he's really kind of part of everything. And so I kind of agree with the idea that he's the most Sandler thing. In the second half, I actually have to wonder if that is a character, like the German professor, like, which is just such a great stock character from like all the way back to Commedia dell'arte, right? Of like the nutty professor character. Like, I feel like that character probably exists in the French farce. And what they did is they took a character that is from the Sandlerverse, and then he shifts, and we literally watch it happen on screen into this whole other character. Because I cannot believe that the Eddie in the second half and the Eddie in the first half are the same Eddie.
I don't disagree.
Shift, right? It's like it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. or Schwartz plays them both amazingly, but like, what is going on?
I mean, if he is the same character, if he is the most method actor of the characters in this film.
Oh man!
Because
and, I'll credit to Schwartzen, because this is like this is his first time, and I'm gonna say a phrase, and it's gonna be a pun, and only you and I are gonna get it. This is his first time off the bench for an Adam Sandler film. He shows up in a couple of other Sandler films before this. He shows up as the weirdo in what's the Will Ferrell skating one with Gunther there,
Blades of Glory.
Right, like it's not that he hasn't made movies before. I mean, he shows up in the Reno 911 movie before this, but this is his first time playing basically like third lead in like in a comedy with Sandler, and so like he definitely brings it, and he's funny moment to moment. I just think that story wise, what the fuck is going on with Eddie?
and that's why I omitted him, because there's already so many like I almost omitted Devlin and her husband, but they're such a big part of the second part of this movie that like
I love the question mark, by the way, on Nicole Kidman, but no question mark on Dave Matthews. Like, that was okay that he showed up. For me, out of anybody in this movie, Dave Matthews showing up was the hardest thing for me to deal with.
Except that Dave Matthews, we might not have touched on any of those movies, but this is not the first time that he's in an Adam Sandler film.
Ooh.
So that's why I'm okay with it. Like, it almost makes sense that, like, oh, we'll get Dave Matthews to play this role.
Yeah.
But Nicole Kidman is part of the whole legitimacy of this movie.
Yeah. Because, well, and like I said, you go to her with a script that's been knocking around Hollywood for literally probably decades at this point, because the Broadway play is from like the fucking 40s. So like this is a known script, not like an amazingly well known one, but there's been an American made movie, there's been a Middle Eastern made movie, there's been a French movie, there's been so many versions of this story already told that if Nicole Kidman heard, oh, they're doing Cactus Flower, which is the original name of it. Mm-hmm. I want to be in that.
I want to be
without
part of
even
Cactus
looking
Flower.
At the rest of it. Right.
And then showing up on set and who knows. But I am going to stop us, because we've touched on a lot of things that lead into something that we call on the show something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. And I think that if we get that established, what we felt on the table, this conversation will be a little bit easier to manage.
No, please. No. Hold me to the formula on this one, because as much as I didn't like this movie, I feel like I'm going to go everywhere with it. So do your, you know.
All right. So something new. I've kind of shared mine already. So if you want to go with yours officially on the record, I think that'd be a good start for this.
Oh, I feel bad if I'm like stepping on your toes here. I don't know what you mean. But I mean, the new thing to talk about here is the shared lead. The idea that Sandler is not the main focus. And he's truly not. Like, there's a lot of time dedicated to Jennifer Aniston, specifically in the second half when you get into the stuff with her and the actual Devlin, whose name I don't know if it was clear, but this is the woman who she hates so much that she has taught her children to refer to poop as Devlin's. And so when she meets, oh man, my character names are going to be all over the place.
It's okay.
When she meets Palmer, she introduces herself as Devlin, because this is the girl that she hates from her sorority. And then lo and behold, Devlin shows up in the movie later. Magical like nonsense happens. So there's a lot of time dedicated to her kind of coming to terms with the fact that she is like, actually, she doesn't hate Devlin. There's just a little piece of herself that she sees in Devlin that she doesn't like. And that's kind of like it's really interesting character work. And Jennifer Aniston is as the amazing actress that she is, handles it super well. Scenes between her and fucking Nicole Kidman are like, actually, I mean, I think this adds to the legitimacy conversation, right? Is like, oh, there's work going on here that we're not used to seeing from side characters in Sandler films. And that's because she's not one, right?
Right. She is a shared lead. Excellent. You did not step on mine, because I was going to say this is the first time in a film like this we're seeing someone like Nicole Kidman, right? She has Oscar nominations under her belt at the time that she is doing this in 2011. She brings a whole level of legitimacy to this film. And it's also, I was going to say, I mean, kind of leading into the shared lead, Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler working together in something, like, it's something 30 years in the making. They have been friends since the 80s, trying to find something that they could do together, and they weren't able to converge and figure that out until 2011.
And she's on Friends, in the early days at least, she's on Friends at the same time that Sandler is on SNL and then blowing up. So there's no way they were not seeing each other all the time at the same parties in New York, right?
He was trying to get her on SNL before she blew up on Friends.
Yeah.
And I like to think, speaking of universes and alternate, parallel, perpendicular universes, there is one where that CBS show that she was working on, like, The Hunches, or I don't remember the name of it, but it was very much Friends, but on CBS. Yeah. And like the Rachel character in Friends, there was a chance that they were going to have to write her out if that show got picked up in addition to Friends.
Jeez.
So like, in the world where that happens, that show doesn't go for 10 seasons. And then Jennifer Aniston, like, off of that, Adam Sandler, hot, she probably becomes Drew Barrymore in a lot of those movies if she's available and not with Friends. So it's so crazy that it brings Jennifer Aniston into the realm of working with Adam Sandler for the first time.
Well, and I think what it does for Aniston and her kind of renaissance in the second half of her career is it's what opens the door for her to be able to do roles like Horrible Bosses and We're the Millers and things like that, right? Like it really kind of it allows her, this movie allows her the opportunity to show people that she can do the frat boy comedy, for lack of a better term. I don't think that truly applies to Sandler, but that's a whole other episode, right? I will say that you mentioned that this was kind of the first time with Nicole Kidman that we really see like the gravitas of an actor coming to a Sandler movie. We talked a little bit about this when we watched Pixels, because we were wondering if it was the idea of Chris Columbus being involved in that you got somebody like Peter Dinklage, right? Because we can't deny that Peter Dinklage in and of himself had tons of gravitas, especially by the time he gets to Pixels, right? But I have to now wonder in retrospect, if, as you're saying, this is 2011, 4 years before we ever get to Pixels, if it's somebody like this coming in and doing this movie with Sandler that really does kind of open that door as well. Because like I said, we at the time kind of just really laid it on the idea that like Chris Columbus says, I'm making a movie, you kind of don't say no, especially if he says like, you know, we're doing a family adventure movie and it's CGI Pac-Man. Like, you know, of course, Peter Dinklage is like, sure, I'm in. Like, you know, I've got 3 days to go to a shoot. But like, I have to wonder now, right? If this is also part of the formula for that.
I think the difference where I highlight Nicole Kidman over like Dinklage, where I say that it's still something new, someone like Nicole Kidman coming into it, is the role of Eddie Plant in Pixels is the kind of role that Peter Dinklage would play. When you look at the other stuff he's done, like both Death at a Funerals, and like he has a sense of humor. He's not one of those people who's like, I'm a Shakespearean actor, I'm not going to work with Adam Sandler. And maybe Nicole Kidman's not like that either, but she presents that way to the fact that when she shows up and Just Go With It, my jaw is kind of on the floor.
It's a deal. It's a big deal. Yeah. For sure.
And I guess just one more, not to like, I don't really need to sneak it in, but I think it will become important further down the line. This is the first time that we see J.D. McFunnigan's in any of the Adam Sandler films that we've covered as part of this show. And that's important. And it's going to make later discussions in this episode and later discussions in the entire course of this podcast. There's going to be important, J.D. McFunnigan's. Even though I don't want it to be.
Yeah. So that was our something new. Yeah. So now next is something old, right?
Yes. And for something old, you know, really, you know what it did for me? It was all of the Adam Sandler people that we have come to take for granted in a movie that Adam Sandler is involved in. Kevin Nealon, Peter, I can't think of his last name, Peter Dante, John, I don't know his last name.
Alan Covert.
But Alan Covert.
The final moment of this movie is a fadeaway shot on Alan Covert, and you're not seeing me do it, but
hey,
I'm doing the finger move.
You want to go to squares, man? Yeah, it's
so I think this is kind of just because I'm just gonna steamroll mine in here because yeah. I think it kind of goes hand in hand with this, but I put for my something old the SNL shuffle, right? Like yeah. the idea of Nealon being there, but also we see Rachel Dratch in there too, right like we've encountered this before, him dipping into the SNL pool for character actors to come in and cover small roles here and there, and I'm right there with you. Yeah, like that's the most Sandler-y thing in the universe about this particular movie. And it makes it hard to kind of argue like my point about how I feel like it doesn't quite fit, because there's just so many great moments. I mean, you offhandedly mentioned Nealon, but like Nealon has an amazing part in this movie that shows up for all of 10 minutes.
I mean, Nealon, if there were no Kevin Nealon in this film, we wouldn't have this film. like just think about that. Kevin Nealon is the Maltese Falcon of Just Go With It. and that's crazy. It really is. And then, you know, I didn't get to touch on them because you brought up Alan Covert, but I mean, Dennis Dugan is the director of this film. Yeah. Dennis Dugan, who brought us Happy Gilmore, and who brought us Little Nicky. Like, mm-hmm. It's also an Adam Sandler director.
Yeah.
So like it feels like all of the old is all of this baggage that we've come to rely on when we're dealing with an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film. And it makes it very difficult to watch this film and not think this might be part of it.
Yeah, but very important to kind of point out that, like, specifically, like, the Nealon-y stuff and even Rachel Dratch, as I said, like, the SNL stuff that really shows up. This is all early movie stuff. Like, yeah, the Alan Covert thing is right at the end, and Dugan's there the whole time. But, like, there's very distinctly, like, a good 45 minutes of this movie where that kind of stuff doesn't happen.
It just stops. Yeah.
I mean, the one person I will point out is, because we've pointed him out in the past, is Patrick, Dan Patrick, right?
That's his name. Dan Patrick. You mean Tanner Patrick?
Tanner Patrick, yeah. I look back at his career as far as like movies go, he's done a fuck ton with Sandler.
He's been in so many Adam Sandler films.
But like he shows up a ton with Sandler, yeah.
But
I mean, other than him and his role could have been anybody. Like, it's funny for us as people that have been studying it, but he doesn't do anything specifically Dan Patrick-esque in that role, right?
It really feels like, and this is, you correct me there, this is a theory that we will put a pin in later, Dan Patrick comes to take over for all of the roles that were previously played by Robert Smigel.
Yeah, okay.
Because I could totally see the Proctor of the decathlon from Billy Madison unfortunately being the guy running the hula contest in Hawaii and still not being happy, his wife still being a huge whore. But, you know, Robert Smigel, his career goes a completely different direction in the 2000s when TV Funhouse picks up and becomes sort of an uncontrollable thing, and Triumph the Insult Comic Dog really picks up and becomes its own thing, that, like, he almost got too big for the Sandlerverse in a way that definitely needs to be explored. But looking back and seeing Dan Patrick again in this film... Yeah, he sort of became that straight man, but only because we know him as the straight man from real life, where Robert Smigel was playing a character.
Yeah, like, I think what it is for me is, like, I start thinking of ways in which I would make this more Sandler-y when I start thinking about wanting to fit it into the universe. So, like, this is the kind of role that I wish that, like, Tim Meadows got the call for, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Patrick does perfectly fine as in this movie, if I'm not trying to make it an Adam Sandler movie. But the second I want to start making it something that's going to please Sandler fans, that's when I start thinking about, like, other, you know, these are the people that I would call up for this. You know, Maya Rudolph probably would have been the Devlin role or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, where to make it really funny, bring in somebody like Julie Bowen or something like that, you know, like to make her.
I mean, if I had my druthers, if I was making this movie and we're way ahead of where this would come in, you make Drew Barrymore Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then, like, the fact that she has stepped into a role of being an Adam Sandler leading man's wife, and she's sort of based that performance on a character played by Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
All sorts of layers on layers on layers there. That, I mean, we don't see, and it's not surprising that we don't see it, but it is just like, that would be the perfect to make this an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film.
Yeah.
But it's very hard. I mean, you bring up Dan Patrick, his line of, no, that's a clean pickup. I can see so many of the players that we know exist in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe doing that line and making it hilarious.
I mean, all props to Sandler and his crew for giving me a moment in cinematic history in which Nicole Kidman's face is not 6 inches from Dave Matthews' ass.
I we need to move on to something borrowed because we'll get distracted and off topic if we start talking mm-hmm. about Dave Matthews probably actually being able to pick up a coconut with his ass.
It wasn't CGI. I mean, it was definitely CGI because the CGI was terrible.
Yeah,
but
it wasn't great CGI. Sorry, Sony. But yeah, so for Borrowed, you're going to have the stage on Borrowed. So I'm just going to lead with The Omen. Of, like, all the movies of cinematic history to be like, we're going to put it into this film. Let's go with The Omen.
Yeah.
Adulterer, fornicator, I will kill you. And, like, that one scene would be, like, not enough to rank in this thing. But then there are a bunch of other Omen jokes. That's like,
when did the Omen remake happen? I wonder if it was kind of off of the back of that.
Like, I certainly feel like the Omen remake happened prior to 2010,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I feel like it was like 2006. I mean, I've got the internet.
Yeah. But I think you're right. I'm pretty sure I was working at Hollywood Video. So it was between 2006 and 2009.
Yeah.
So more than likely, but it is just, I don't know why it is there. And it is
2006,
just
2006. Yeah.
Yeah.
Schreiber, Julia Stiles. Yep. Yeah, man. I mean, like, part of it is there because, like, you know, the Omen is one of those ones that the remake is the one of those ones that pops out and kind of like supercharges everybody's love for like remaking old horror movies. And then you see like a slew of like reboots and remakes come out after that. So I have to wonder, like, we've talked so much about Sandler's love of old film and film in general that, like, if it's not just on his mind, you know?
Yeah. I mean, also, I think leading into the fact that this is just Cactus Flower.
Well, like, right. So to that, yeah. Right, the big thing for me that is the Borrowed is the trope of the fake it till you make it romance. And what I mean by that is the two people that are pretending to be in love in order to trick everybody else. But then lo and behold, by the end of the movie, they realize, oh, no, we actually are in love. Right. And what's really funny is I'm watching that and I had that thought and I was like, but there's somebody recently that's really been knocking that one out of the park like multiple times. And I realized it's that dude from all of the Netflix romantic comedies, Noah Cantaneo, I think I'm saying his name right.
I think that's
the
right.
The guy that was in like All the Boys I Loved Before, which is where this trope is present in there. He also does the Perfect Date, which is the one where he plays the guy that starts the app where he's like, I'll go on a date with you in order to make somebody else jealous and that sort of thing. And then, you know, again, falls in love with one of the people that he goes on the date with. Like, he's just got like he does that trope a thousand times over, and I'll watch it a million times more, right? But yeah, that idea that the fake it till you make it relationship is such an old school trope. And I knew as I was writing it, I was like, well, yeah, but this is coming from such an old play that no one like that's what's going to happen, right? But it's there, right? Like, and so it started by kind of my brain thinking about the idea of why Sandler would do this. And it's because it's his love of old Hollywood. It's his love of cinema and films that clearly leads to him getting his hands on the cactus flower script, whatever movie it's trying to be, and him being like, we could do this, right? And then, like, you know, they start pumping up a little bit of backstory in order to make it funnier, and then they start adding a bunch of stuff to it, and the next thing you know, they've got an hour on the front end that's very Sandler-esque because it's not in the script originally, and then the back half is the script as it was probably tossing around for a few years.
I can totally see that. Sorry, I just, yeah, it all checks out. It just, I don't know why you would allow him to change the front half and not the back half.
Well, I don't think it's a change, right?
Yeah.
I think it's legitimately like, so to really kind of blow this out, the original story for Cactus Flower, the idea is that it is a man, I believe, like a dentist or something, and he's got a young lover who is madly in love with him, but he has been lying to and saying that he's been married for years because he doesn't want to do anything more than just sleep with her and take her out places. But he has no interest in not being a bachelor anymore. So he lies to her for years about being married. So eventually she gets so distraught about this idea that she's sleeping with a married man and how much she loves him that she almost kills herself. So, like, suicide, funny, haha. But I mean, it's, you know, it's French farce. I have no defense of
go
it.
Go with it.
But yeah. So he, in that, realizing that how far she's willing to take it, he realizes he needs to kind of break this, but doesn't want to, like, completely blow her mind. So he asks his young assistant, who in this case would be the Jennifer Aniston character, to pretend to be his wife so that they can pretend to get divorced so that he can finally be with this other woman. And then, of course, French farce antics ensue, crazy characters show up, they run away, and it leads to him realizing that he's always kind of like the assistant, and he does finally break it off with the young lover. I can't tell you what happens to the young lover, who at the beginning of the play we knew loved this man enough that she would kill herself.
So
you consider all of that, and if you look at the moment that they leave for Hawaii and all of that, and maybe just a couple of scenes before that, if you kind of get the idea that, like, that is that whole story. It is the 45 minutes to an hour preceding that just maybe didn't exist. So it's not that he changes anything. He just comes in and he's just like, well, obviously we have to put the backstory in about, like, why he's like this. So then you get the first couple of moments of this movie with the wedding scene that goes awry and then he runs off, right? And then from there, you need to establish a couple of moments of him being a bit of a jerk, right? And then the next thing you know, like, Sandler's, like, adding a scene there, adding a scene here. Here's where I have to meet the kids. Here's where it goes good with me. Like, and then the next thing you know, you got an hour of film because he didn't write anything for the first half. So all of his creative juices go into creating backstory that ends up blowing up to an hour long. Right. All of this is speculation. I want to make that clear again. Like I don't have any, like, written evidence of any of this. But you can see why this movie suddenly starts to feel like the first half of this movie is something else entirely, is because that's really the only half that wasn't there before. And Sandler created it. And so it has this whole life to it. It has this whole feel to it. And then suddenly at some point, they're like, let's leave all that behind and run to Hawaii for an hour.
God, back to Hawaii. Imagine being Adam Sandler getting to do two movies in Hawaii, and one with Drew Barrymore and one with Jennifer Aniston. What a life he leads.
I mean, but that's his whole shtick, right?
Yeah.
He does these things, and he can afford to do the destination film with his company and all that sort of stuff. And
this might be the most Adam Sandler film ever, and I'm excited to jump into that once we share our blues. And then move forward.
What's your blue, Dev?
My blue is Dr. Daniel Maccabee's entire wardrobe and color palette. Specifically, if I had to focus, if I had to focus on the one outfit where I was like, really? Really? It's when he is going to introduce Palmer to his ex-wife, and he is wearing blue jeans and a blue t-shirt, and Palmer is done up to the nines, and then Jennifer Aniston comes in as Devlin Maccabee, dressed to the 11s.
Oh man,
$1,700 yes. Shoes, all this, and I'm like, and you went with the blue t-shirt and jeans
that he knew she was gonna wear because he bought all that stuff for
I know
her.
It's just
not like he was like, oh, you got more dressed than I expected you to. He
no
knew
that's
exactly.
Later that's later he says you got more dressed than you expected to at JD McFunnigan's. But yeah, it's
exactly.
Like
oh man, like, and I There's the reason for that, and this is part of the reason. In fact, this might be my largest reason why I think this really doesn't fit into the cinematic universe for me, is because this is the first time that we see a sexy, successful Sandler character as our lead. This is not a character that is like the hapless, like loser on the sidelines that's fighting his way to the top. He is not an underdog. And so in order to still make you connect with him, in order to still pull off that idea of that, is they literally, every second they can, put him in a blue collar.
Yeah.
Like, no joke, it is, that's the thought process.
It's the relaxation shirt. The I have this one in my notes, too, because I'm just like, I don't know. It's just every shirt he wears is like variations on the color blue. And you're not wrong, but it's just like, it's so blue. Adam Sandler's character is so blue in this movie.
The one thing that we have not quite addressed, in fact, at all, and we should talk about it, is the blue that I have for this movie. And part of the reason a large majority of the reason why I, at the end of the day, I also just think this is just a movie that should be left to time. The body shaming elements of this film are atrocious. And that word is exactly the word that I want to use. Like, this entire it comes from the first half. I'm not even going to pretend that it's not like this was just in the old script, because there is some stuff once they get to Hawaii and all that. But it really is. It is the first half of this film, including the first 5 minutes of this film, where there is just joke after joke after joke about people's physicality and about how ugly people basically just don't deserve to be happy. Like, it is horrendous, the amount of body shaming comedy that is in this movie. And it's built into the script, because he, in the first few moments of the movie, and I think somebody else, but I don't want to, like,
sister.
Start.
Yeah.
There is just some horrible prosthetic, like, noses going on in the first few moments of this film.
I was reminded of Ocean's 13.
Mm,
and the nose did not play.
Yeah. yeah, the nose doesn't play. Man, it's just upsetting, right? And like, to the point where you start to, like, wonder if there's some, like, offensive imagery on screen that maybe you're just not, like, privy to, but there's just
I'm sorry that you're not privy to. Their last name is Maccabee, and they're given huge noses that the bride, who is revealed to have been cheating on Danny the whole time, that's the tragic, like, break-his-heart moment, and her gaggle of bridesmaids are not quiet or kind to how disgusted they are by how large the noses are on the family she's going to be joining.
Yeah, and it's not like, oh, this one thing happens, and like, normally when we talk about these things in these movies, we say, like, oh, yeah, this one scene just doesn't work anymore. But the problem with this particular issue is it continues, because then there's the entire scene with Rachel Dratch. Like, they're to the point where there is just an undeservedly long amount of time dedicated to him and Jennifer Aniston laughing in her face, to her, about her face. It is just wild. Like, there's just all of this stuff that goes on, and like, I applaud the moment when she steps out and Nick Swartzen is like into her and she like lays him out and is just like, fuck off. But that's not enough to make up for the 5 minute scene we just watched, where we just watched Jennifer Aniston, considered one of the hottest people in Hollywood at this point. And I don't mean that just as like Seagen's being gross. I mean, literally, like, People Magazine has labeled her this. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, as I said, it's the first time that we've seen Sandler, who is in this role where we're supposed to understand him to be just undeniably sexy at this point. He's getting women left and right. Like, this guy is supposed to be like fucking Good Luck Chuck, who's just shows up everywhere and sleeps with everybody. Like, it's just it's this weird, like, thing where we're supposed to be told, like, Adam Sandler is the sexiest thing on earth and everybody else is a fucking goon and you're just supposed to go with it. Right? And it's just like, I'm not comfortable with a ton of this.
I will say, not to defend it, I don't like that scene with Rachel Dratch either, but mostly because it seems like what they're laughing at is that she's got the Rock's eyebrow thing. Mm-hmm. And, like, first of all, it dates the movie awfully. Like, I'm like, this is clearly early 2010s, where Dwayne Johnson raising his one eyebrow is the funniest thing in the world to us still, because he hasn't become a legitimate actor yet. And actually, I don't know if he's a legitimate actor like Nicole Kidman yet. I don't think he's gotten any Oscar nominations, but he's clearly, he's now Dwayne Johnson. He's not The Rock anymore.
Right.
So that's an important distinction. But, like, it also, like, it just feels like, why is this happening? Like, mm-hmm. can we get to something more? Because it feels like it's a momentum killer. The pacing of the film is interrupted by it. And it's very strange. But then, like, to also go back to the other stuff, I mean, it's really hard not to look at Danny and Eddie in the beginning of this film and not just see horrific Hollywood Jewish stereotypes with the huge curly hair and all the pimples on Eddie. And then you go forward into the film and he's become a plastic surgeon and he's fixed all of these problems for himself and for Eddie. Yeah. And it works for him probably because he has the wedding ring, which there's another borrowed that we could have looked at, is the fact that a man who is married is irresistible to women.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that is currently seeing a renaissance in the form of the unicorn trope, where a young widower is, like, the hottest fucking thing in the world because he's available, but he's proven that he can commit. And, yeah, we saw it with, I can't think of his name, Kenan Thompson's character in the Kenan Show. Is
And there was literally a show named the
Yeah, I can't think of his name.
Justified.
Yeah, I can't think of his name, and I'm really upset because I love
Goggins.
Him. Yeah, Walter Goggins. Yeah, like, that's a whole thing that's going on. So in modern times, in the present, we've seen the evolution of the guy with a wedding ring is irresistible trope to guy who was married and now his wife is dead.
Yeah, no, it's okay because the wife is gone.
Can fucking get it. Before it was, he can be lying about having a wife, right? George Costanza did it. I mean, that's the other thing, right? This Adam Sandler character basically based his whole thing on something George Costanza did.
Yeah. And just to because I don't want to let the body shaming thing go.
Yeah.
It translates in the back half of the movie into something else. And as far as I'm concerned, it's still a shaming tactic. It's just that it's disguised in the ways in which Brooklyn Decker's body is treated, especially once they get to Hawaii and she's allowed to just walk around in a bathing suit for the rest of the movie. Like, the ways in which she is treated as if she is heaven on earth and everybody is just eyeballing her, to the point where like you get horrendous lines from Nick Swardson's character just about like, yeah I'd make up a fake family for that, I think was the exact line that he uses, right? And but then all of this is put up against Jennifer Aniston, who, as I've said at this point, we all know to be an extremely attractive actress. Like, there's no reason why we shouldn't. Is it just the fact that she's a mom and she has children? Is it the fact that she's older? Like, what is going on here? It's very wild for me to sit here and see these scenes where we're supposed to understand that, like, Brooklyn Decker is just stealing attention away from everybody in the room, including one Jennifer Aniston. And the worst part is that then I start saying to myself, well, it shouldn't be a competition in the first place. This movie's put me in this really weird position where I'm now ranking these actresses, and like, I don't want to be doing that. I just like am finding myself falling into these really gross habits because this movie is fully supporting them. And you know, we've talked in the past about Sandler and the good old boys attitude and about how that's very problematic because it's underlying in all of the movie. And what happens in this movie is it presents itself full force. It's not underlying in the first half of this movie. And then it sneaks under the covers for the second half, so you start to kind of feel better about it because all of the body shaming has seemingly gone away until you realize, no, it's still happening. It's just that they flip the script on it, and instead of shaming everybody for being ugly, they're just putting this woman on a pillar for basically being an object.
And in so doing, you also thus shame everybody who is not on that pillar. Exactly. Everybody else falls away as the dregs of society. Even
he sneaks out, like, in that scene, in the hula scene, in the hula mm-hmm. competition scene, yeah. when we have that woman on stage that then doesn't get clapped at because she's not hot enough. And that's
which
just,
is what
that's
I was
it, rearing its head.
I was going to cite that same scene as proof that it's the age thing with Jennifer Aniston, because mm-hmm. the two women who are not given any applause from the audience, and like kudos to Dan Patrick's character. I don't know if it's written, I don't know if it's improv in the moment, right? Because he is that type of person who was a sports commentator. So maybe they're just like, commentate this hula contest, Dan. Yeah. It's an older woman is also someone who gets no applause from the audience. So in that scene they are saying, if you are old, you have no value. And if you are overweight, you have no value. The body shaming is all over this film. I mean, the body shaming is at the worst part. And it didn't take until the second time that I actually understood where it was coming from. But it's with Bailey Madison's character, her daughter Maggie.
Yeah.
Where she refuses to eat. She doesn't eat. And I didn't understand that until the second time through, when they go visit at the office and she's like, I want change and I want you to eat the food that is bought for you. And then when he's convincing the children to play his fake children, he takes them to Pizza Hut, you know, for the sponsorship dollars. Let's be honest. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that this takes place at a Hilton and not at a Madison hotel. Right?
Right.
And perhaps too, it's power, because that if it had been at a Madison hotel, then this would definitely be in the ASCU. It'd be a much harder argument, where he's like, you need to eat that pizza. And then he tells, you know, Jennifer Aniston later, yeah, she ate three whole pieces of pizza, and he makes her eat the quesadillas. And that is because Bailey Madison's character wants to be an actress. So she is trying to live up to that ideal of the skinny woman by just not eating.
Yeah.
It's all over this film. Oh, I'm real grossed out. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just, like, there was stuff about this film that bothered me, and I appreciate you putting it into words.
And that's just like I said, that's just one of the things, because as you pointed out, there's so many other blue elements of this movie that just kind of just get away from them. I mean,
that 36 seconds when Brooklyn Decker is walking out of the ocean, mm-hmm. may be the most uncomfortable I have ever been watching a film.
Yeah.
Her body moves against physics in so many ways that I'm like, how did they, is this why the CGI on the coconut doesn't look very good? Because they were busy putting the Ninja Gaiden, you can jiggle the boobs engine to work for Brooklyn Decker in this film?
Well, they're using model shoot tactics where, like, she's probably moving in ways that nobody would normally walk, but what they then do is they slow it down and they shoot it in just the right way so that you're just getting these moment to moments things. I mean, like, it's the same tactics that have been used in Sports Illustrated and Playboy and in all of these ways in order to catch still images, and seeing it in motion is uncomfortable. like you know, there's the people talk about these, like, these glamour shots of women for, like, pinups and things like that, and nobody ever points out the fact that how stupidly uncomfortable those positions would be, and they're so unnatural. And so what you're pointing at is we're watching 36 seconds of a model having to do that in action, and it's just weird to watch.
And it's one of the trailers for this movie. Like, that's how they sold people to go see Just Go With It, was Brooklyn Decker walking out of the ocean.
Yeah, the poster for this film is a happy, smiling Adam Sandler, a grumpy-looking Jennifer Aniston, and then Brooklyn Decker's butt between the two of them. Like, that is the poster for this film.
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, I going off of your definition of blue, which I'll figure it out someday, but I couldn't get over all the blue shirts that this guy was wearing. it's unsettling how much they use sex to sell this film.
Well, and just to throw this one out there too, because I mean the whole plot of this movie is based on it. This could have been my something old, my borrowed, blue, anything. Is the idea of the relationship built entirely on lies? That is not anything new to movies, not anything new to Adam Sandler movies, but like the idea that this entire movie is also predicated on. I mean, I think one of my notes, now that we're getting into this, I think one of my notes is from Brooklyn Decker's perspective, this could potentially be a horror movie. Like if she is on day like 4 of being in Hawaii with these people and she just said to him, we should get married, and then suddenly she finds out though all of this has just been one giant lie and none of these people are who she thinks they are, that would put her in like a mental institution of some kind, right? Like
so let's talk about something that exists in all of entertainment, and that is show don't tell. And you know what this film does? It tells us what happens when Adam Sandler leaves Brooklyn Decker at the altar. And do you know why? Because if they showed us,
yes,
it would ruin everybody involved in this film's career.
Yeah.
Because that would have just made everything real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't show you the breakup. They don't show you the moment when he has to come clean. My note is you never see the comeuppance for this entire plot. And it is the biggest plot hole in the entire story. Like, the fact that there is no moment where he finally has to come clean is, honestly, it's some of the worst screenwriting I've ever seen. To not have that moment when he has to face the truth is such an injustice from a moviegoer standpoint. It basically solidifies that that's not why you were here. You were never here for the story anyway. Well, what was I here for then? Adam Sandler fart jokes and Brooklyn Decker in a bikini, I guess. It's like, that's what you told me I was here for, and you took away the only movie part of this movie. Like, it is unforgivable.
Yeah, it is. It's next level. That being said, I do want to start. I feel like I see where this train is going. Mm-hmm. I see the grade of the track, and I would just like to pay some tribute. I understand that it is scripted. I know that it is a movie, but Michael, Jennifer Aniston's character's son, hearing about the yes and just go with it mentality that has to be on display if these lies are going to work, and using that as his way to get Danny to take him to Hawaii to swim with the dolphins is a chef's kiss. It's just this moment that comes from nowhere that, like, I mean, it doesn't come from nowhere. He establishes that he wants to go swim with the dolphins. Like, mm-hmm. That'd be fucking crazy if the kid just mentions it from nowhere. But the intelligence on display and the fact that they all just have to go with it, I love it. It is something that I truly love in this film.
Yeah, I'll give it that. Like, I like the moment. I think it's really good. I think it's a really great way for them to establish the huge turn that this movie takes to the point where you don't quite think about it until it's too late. Like, once they're in Hawaii, you're suddenly like, wait a minute, how the fuck did we get here? And like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't really pay attention.
Keep talking because I need to find the place in my notes.
Yeah.
Because I believe I disagree.
But there's like a that moment, I think I would appreciate it better if the script as a whole was not completely undercut by the fact that there's a 10-minute scene just missing from the back half, right? Like, the fact that you don't ever get to see any resolution to the actual conflict of this movie is so unforgivable to me that, like, it blinds me to anything else in this script that might be okay. I will say that is probably the rose stone, as it were, to the archway that is the beginning of this movie that made them make an hour of film beforehand. They were like, well, okay, so we at least need to establish a reason why they go to Hawaii. Well, okay, they go to Hawaii because Jennifer Aniston's kid says something and he's trying to fake being their dad, so he says yes. Okay, but why is he that invested in faking being their dad? Oh, well, you see, this happened. Well, okay, why that? Oh, because this happened. Oh, why that? Because this happened. And then suddenly you find yourself putting on a prosthetic nose and fucking fake acne on Nick Schwartz in an hour earlier, right? Like I feel like that moment is probably the moment that led to the rest of the Sandler-esque stuff.
Yeah. What I wrote during the J.D. McFunnigan scene was, Palmer and Davey have been on two dates, and she is already all in, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Because she, like, you want to talk like this is kind of a horror movie? She is also a level of, like, committed to this man that makes no sense. Like, yeah. I'm going to go to Hawaii with you. We've been on two dates. And yeah. then, like, Jennifer Aniston, who's known him this whole life, she's like, I can't believe I have to go to Hawaii with you. Shut up, Jennifer Aniston. He's taking you to Hawaii. And kudos to Nick Swardson taking advantage when he can. Like, it's like,
let's not celebrate everybody being shitty.
Oh, I'm not I'm not celebrating it. It's just one of those moments where, like,
Jennifer Aniston's character saying, hey, you're an asshole and I don't want to go on vacation with you is probably the only sane thing that her character says the rest of this movie.
True. That's very true. You know what this movie feels like, though? And I actually have it here, and I'm glad I had to look at my notes for it. This is kind of like a less culty Yes Man.
Yeah,
where it's
yes.
not just Jim Carrey saying yes.
Thinking, yeah, I was just thinking the whole Yes Man thing is really on display here, too.
It is
yeah.
everybody else just having to say yes and go with it. And there's the movie twin that I was thinking of for this movie. Because it also weirdly could kind of fit with, you know, we talked on the Say Report about No Strings Attached and Friends with Benefits. I
same year, by the way.
What? Yeah, same. Exactly. I'm like, does this weirdly fit in as a third prong? But no, it is very much like Yes Man-esque, but if mm-hmm. everybody had to say yes, not just the leading man.
Yeah, and I will say this. I think all of this that you're talking about really stems from the idea that we're supposed to believe that Sandler's character in this movie is so sexy and charming that everybody just goes with it when he says this thing. And this even goes to what you're talking about with Brooklyn Decker just being in all in on their second date. We are supposed to believe that this is the kind of person that he is. And so to that point, I really take umbrage with the idea that this is an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. I think that there's a lot of stuff that it picks up on its way past the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. There's no denying that there are elements of the universe stuff in this movie. But I just think that there is some fundamental stuff that is just broken, not least of which is the fact that the story is... We have talked about how Sandler movies will just allow things to happen sometimes for the sake of, like, the story, you know, having, like, a happy ending or something like that. You know, like, Buscemi showing up with a gun at the end of Billy Madison. It's been there from day one. Us not getting the scene of him breaking up with Brooklyn Decker is so far beyond that, that it is just poor filmmaking. That is just a funny joke that, in an absurd comedy, just works. In this... It doesn't work. Not seeing that scene is not okay. Like, I'm not okay with missing out on, again, the resolution to the 2 hour long conflict I have just watched.
The weird thing is, you say that you don't get to see the resolution of the conflict. I think they kind of subvert that by there not ever really being conflict.
But you okay?
That's incredible to say. That I hate that I just said it, but like.
To make it not a problem that this whole thing has been a lie means that it has been a waste of time. That what you're saying then is there's been no stakes.
Oh, and there are no stakes.
And that is completely so. Then that is so anti Sandler and every story that we've talked about, every movie that we've talked about universe so far has had such big stakes on the line. For Sandler's character specifically, it's been the world every time. Whether it's his world in Billy Madison or the world in Little Nicky, like it is the idea that there are no stakes and no conflict in this movie mean that there's no point to it. That means that there's nothing going on. And so, like, to me, that's more to the point that it just doesn't fit in, like as far as filmmaking goes. And then to that, character wise, this character is nothing like any Sandler we've seen before. And I'm not saying that Sandler's character cannot be like sexy and charming, because we do kind of get that when guys like Happy, like he is sexy and there is a charm to him. Like, it's why Julie Bowen's character falls for him. And the same thing goes for even Hubie, is that there is an element to him that some people find charming. But in this movie, he's we are supposed to believe that he's playing the role of charming to everybody, but we as the audience actually know he's kind of scum because he's lying to everybody. So it's just gross. You know what I mean? Like, there's a disingenuous feel to this character that he doesn't fit in with anybody else.
Taking it to the further level as to why this wouldn't work as an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film, based on what you've just said, he needs to be saved. Danny Maccabee is a man who is drowning, and unlike all of the other characters that Adam Sandler has played that we have looked at in this film, he needs Jennifer Aniston to come along and throw him a lifeline. And that right there might be the biggest transgression against this film for it slotting into the universe as we've established it thus far.
I want to unpack that a little bit because I see where you're going with that, but I don't want to just outright say that his characters before have never needed help. They've always needed help. I mean, the idea that, like, Billy needed to have Julie Bowen, who was...
No, Billy is Veronica Vaughn. Bridget Wilson.
Bridget Wilson, right. But he needed Veronica Vaughn to whip him into shape in the third act of that movie, right? Like, he needed, Happy needed somebody to come along and tell him, like, he was worth more than just the money, right? Like, there's always been that element of him needing there's a great line in Gross Point Blank with John Cusack that he talks about that moment when you just get whipped in the face. So they use some probably super problematic word that's supposed to be foreign in order to explain it. But, like, I think of that moment all the time where basically the universe comes along and kicks you in the nuts and shows you, like, what the path you're supposed to be on. Sandler characters have always kind of needed that. But this movie he doesn't just need that. He needs somebody to completely change who he is as a person at this point. It is not like, hey, you've got good in you. We just need to make sure that that's the thing that's leading in the front. We've always talked about how Sandler's characters have always kind of towed that line between not good and evil, but, you know, charming and asshole-ish, right? Mm-hmm. But this character is just atrocious. Like, it is upsetting. So it's not just that this character needs Jennifer Aniston to come along and save him, because we have seen that before. He needs her to come along and change him.
Yeah.
And that's the upsetting part.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to think of... I was trying to show off that, like, Veronica Vaughn doesn't need Billy. She's not one of those women, like, in a weird way, like, Jennifer Aniston needs him as much as he needs her. Like, yes.
That comes from the sharing the lead, right?
Yeah.
Is that she also needs to be changed. I actually wrote in my notes that they have to make it a point once they get to Hawaii and they introduce the real Devlin in Kim Basinger,
in Nicole Kidman. I get why you did that, though.
But the reason that they need to introduce that character is they need to show you that Jennifer Aniston is just as bad as he is in some ways. Because up to this point, she has been a marvelous, like, fantastic mother and a good friend. So we need to see that she also needs him. Otherwise, she is not another lead. She is just, you know, the trophy at the end of this movie. So, yeah, like the fact that we are now looking at a leading lady that does, in fact, need Sandler's character in order to better herself is completely against one of my major tenets of the universe.
Yeah. And it's – you're not – oof. It is – but it's just really heavily on display in mm-hmm. terms of exactly what you're talking about, in that, like, there is no comeuppance moment because, like, even Jennifer Aniston, when she goes to Nicole Kidman and she's like, I've just been lying. Nicole Kidman, me too. Do you want to make out? Like, she doesn't actually say, do you want to make out? But that's sort of what it feels like. It feels like everything else up to this point is now forgotten.
But at least we get that scene for the two of them. You know, I'll take that. I will take a scene where two people come together to resolve a conflict and they resolve it in a somewhat unbelievable way. At least it's there.
At least you're acknowledging that a conflict existed and attempting to resolve it. Yes. It's not. So I was sitting up there with Brooklyn Decker, the woman that I met 2 weeks ago. And, like, I don't want to marry this woman I've only known for 2 weeks. I want to marry the woman I've known for the last 12 years.
But don't get me wrong, if I had known her for 12 years, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because this is not about you. It's essentially the gist of the end of this movie.
And now I'm married to Jennifer Aniston, and then I ask people ask me about the ring, I say it's because I'm married to the best woman I've ever known, or something. I don't know, I kind of checked out at that point in the film.
I mean, this movie, I'm going to, at this point, like, just remind everybody that this movie lost me from the first moment, not only with the body shaming stuff, not only with the really gross, like, I mean, like I said, I felt like it was upsettingly racist, and so I'm glad that you're on the same page as me. I wanted to make sure I was not being, like, overly sensitive there. But the other thing is that tied up in that, I just, fuck any character, any male character that's going to start acting like I've been burned once, so all women must feel my wrath. Because there is like a maliciousness to the ways in which he treats women going forward because of that moment. It's not just, I realized that like I didn't click with this woman that I thought I did, so I'm going to discover myself by like sleeping around. Guys do that, and any guy out there that is out there trying to figure himself out by sexually exploring things, sexual exploration is not the bad guy here. It's the fact that there is a malicious intent behind his sexual exploration, because he is trying to trick women, sleep with them, and then he has no interest in ever treating them as anything more than just a trophy for the night. So like, fuck that.
I mean, there's a lot behind his comment to Brooklyn Decker that this is the first time I've ever connected with someone possibly in my entire life. Like, the guy's almost 40 and he's never felt like he's connected with a woman. Like, that's a scary character. That is a scary character that you are giving me as the like funny, charming, romantic lead in this film.
Well, and because we know as the audience, the thing that makes that weirder and gross is not that it's taken him this long to find somebody to connect with, but that we've seen him, like, avoid connecting with other people. So it's not just, like, this is the first time that I've connected with a woman. This is the first time that I haven't been able to keep my guard up. You know what I mean? Like, I have actively tried to not connect with anybody before, but you're just so beautiful that I just couldn't do that this time.
I mean, one step further than that, though, it's one of those moments where he's not wearing the one ring. I mean, like, they have him do the Gollum voice with "my precious." Like, there's some borrowing from Lord of the Rings too with how he views that wedding ring. Why does he have the wedding ring on in the beginning? That's where this film loses me. We see him leave his wedding, so then you don't have your wedding band on until after the ceremony.
I mean, I'm not too familiar with Jewish marriages, but I am right there with you. As far as I would be aware, he would not be wearing it before the wedding. Give me a moment of him, like, at the bar, like, contemplating it and then trying it on and then have a woman, like, miss it. Like, there's ways to fix that, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's like, the worst part about that.
It's an easy fix.
It's such an egregious, weird plot hole.
Of just, like, I don't know. It's just so strange that,
it's
like,
weird.
He's
weird.
Inexplicably wear, like, it almost makes it look like he had already married her and then he heard all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then, like, I gotta get this marriage annulled. I'm gonna go out drinking first at a singles bar in the 80s.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And then, he is a despicable character. We've talked about Eric Gordon being, like, the absolute bottom in terms of immorality. Mm-hmm. Danny McAbee is his apprentice in so many ways.
That's another big hole for me as far as the universe goes, is there is no malicious face of evil here, right? Like there's nobody that we can lay like all of the bad of this movie at the feet of, except for our Sandler character.
At the feet of another Sandler character, Jackie Sandler's Veruca at the beginning. But,
I mean, I guess, but even then,
no, I don't agree with that at all.
Right, yeah.
Like that,
yeah,
that is giving him carte blanche to be a shitty human being.
Well, now that we know what Danny is capable of, there's this weird part of you that has to wonder if, like, if she could just, if she knew that about him, right? If she was just like, yeah, I mean, you know, he's the kind of guy that if given the chance, he would use women, so why don't I get to use men? Just because I'm given the opportunity and he's not doesn't make me any better or worse than him. And I don't love that line of thought, but, like, it's kind of hard for you to hate her as much as you are supposed to when you see the kind of guy that he is able to become years down the line.
Yeah, untethered. Once she releases his tether from, I guess, being a decent human being,
like, which apparently is completely only, it's so fragile that it is broken entirely by this one woman breaking his heart in this way.
I mean, it's on his wedding day. Like, it's not like, is that just some random party he finds out?
But I mean, we're talking about a villain origin story.
Yeah, like, that's what we're exactly. Talking. And he is a villain in a lot of ways. It's, you're not wrong. You know what the biggest transgression is, though, in this film? Who the fuck flies to Hawaii without booking a hotel first?
I know. You were so angry you felt the need to text the entire group about that, and I don't disagree with you. The fact that he shows up at that hotel and is just like, oh, right, I need a room. Like, good on that hotel concierge for being like, tell you what, the only rooms we got left are
the presidential and the Waldorf Astoria suites. One's 8,000 a night, one's 12,000 a night. And it's like, this guy is fucking... They're there for a good amount of time. Like... But yeah, that's like when he's like, oh, I don't have reservations. I flew everybody to Hawaii without reservations. It's like, you had to book the flights, right? You had to... Why don't you just also book a hotel?
Yeah, man.
You fucking monster person. I just think everything's going to work out for me because that's how it's happened since my heart was broken. Like, it's such a weird correlation of events to create a character like Danny Maccabee.
Yeah. I think that this movie so atrociously messes with the idea of a Sandler-style film in the universe that I think in the fact that, for me, it doesn't fit in, it actually ends up creating a rule by not adhering to it. And that is the fact that Sandler's character has to... What's the best way to put this? Like... Sandler's character cannot have it all, like, and that is key for a Sandler universe film. The second that we are seeing Adam Sandler in a position where he's kind of got everything, and maybe this plays more into the rule that already exists, is that he's the everyman, right? Is that, like, the idea that he needs to be an everyman that we can relate to, and they try so hard to make him that in this one, but he just isn't that in this movie.
Yeah. It, you are not wrong at all. And to the point that I'm going to write it. I mean, it's the everyman thing. That's exactly what it is. Danny Maccabee is not an everyman. He's a no man. No man is like this.
Yeah,
we cannot,
yeah.
It would be almost impossible to see yourself in every aspect of that character.
I mean, like, even the joke we just made about the hotel room stuff, like, yeah, it's insane that he doesn't book those rooms. But again, in the true nature of this film, there's no real conflict there. The guy says, well, we actually do have two rooms. They just cost, you know,
$20,000 a night. Yeah.
And he just hands him a credit card and the problem solved. There's no problem there. I mean, imagine the hilarity that would ensue if they had to fake staying in the hotel on top of everything else. But nope, that's not even part of it.
Oh, man, there are ways to make this a better movie, and I'm okay that they don't happen.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that you would have gotten away from some of the problematic language and actions on display in this film. I guess we've already kind of dipped into it. Does this fit into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
No, I mean, I stand by my feeling that, again, I think it picks up some passengers, and I think there's definitely elements to talk about here that Sandler brings to the table, but that cannot be enough going forward. Just because Sandler's in it isn't the reason to include it in the universe, right? So if we're drawing hard lines, this movie doesn't cross it.
I think I would like to propose another rule.
Okay.
And you let me know about this. And that rule is just because more than Adam Sandler shows up in a film doesn't guarantee that a film is part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
I mean, yeah,
you know what I'm getting with that?
That.
Like,
yeah.
I think because J.D. McFunnigan's, right, I've been dicking around with it. I've been jumping all around. That is the kangaroo from Big Daddy to the fact that with the Showtime Pizza Band, J.D. McFunnigan performs the Go to Sleep song from Big Daddy.
Right.
And, like, when you look at all of the not established cinematic universes, but, like, the Pixar universe theory, right? That is enough of a thread in that theory to say, without a doubt, just go with it as part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And no, those are just flotsam from the Adam Sandler cinematic universe slipping down the quantum drain pipe and showing up in another realm entirely.
Yeah, I think this is a cinematic universe, but it is not the one that we have been living in for the last season. So I can definitely get behind the idea. And we maybe have to refine that rule a bit as we go along here, but that's part of the process, right?
Right.
But I think the idea that it can't, there has to be more than just a few passing references to merit it being in that universe.
I mean, and those are the laws that we've been establishing all along, right?
Right.
And like, but also leaning this movie against other films, right? There are magical forces at play in this film.
Mm-hmm.
There have to be some magical forces at play in this. For all intents and purposes, we haven't watched the movie yet, but let's imagine that Adam Sandler's Clarence is Christopher Walken from Click, and he is manipulating and guiding things. He's the reason that Kevin Nealon's son falls down the stairs and cuts his leg so that Adam Sandler can meet Brooklyn Decker, so then Adam Sandler can be ready to love again and find his forever love in Jennifer Aniston.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
there's
clearly a magical force that allows all of this conflict to resolve. Like, it's almost like a Cupid or an adjustment bureau or a TVA, to talk of Loki, to try to destroy the negativity that these things have brought into the existing Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And this is the perfect way to do it. What we are seeing is a multiversal branch off of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Sure.
And by the end of it, maybe it comes back in line with everything that we know before. But this film and the events within it clearly do not exist within the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I'm sorry. I got into a thing there.
I can see colors again.
I'm sorry.
No, man. I mean, like, you know, I have felt this way since I watched it, and I've clearly had my issues with it. And so, like, this is not news to me. But but no, you said it beautifully.
I mean, you were just quiet. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't saying anything or establishing something that you couldn't get behind.
I am never going to interrupt when you're making me look correct.
Oh, okay. There is something that exists in the Devin Seajan cinematic universe.
Yeah, there's a rule for you.
All right, so this is strange in a way, because this is the first film that we're not putting on the pile, right? I mean, on the cartographic chart, it shows up in some way. It goes off the edge and onto
it's
another
the dark
sheet of
middle
paper.
Middle season, baby. Like, this is what we do. Yeah, man. No. I mean, like, we, you know, it had to happen eventually, and I'm kind of glad we ripped the Band-Aid off on the first one, because, like, I didn't want to be 10 movies into the second season and finally start talking about things that didn't work. Like, we need to establish some things that don't work. If not for us, for the sake of anybody out there listening to this, so they understand that we are willing to draw hard lines about these things, you know? And you know, same goes, like I said at the beginning of this episode, for if you disagree with any of the movies from before fitting in, if you feel like this one does fit, like, I don't want to I don't want to silence that. Like, talk to me. Like, what worked for you in this movie that clearly didn't work for me? Like, talk to me about that.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, get at us. We're the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at Gmail. I'd like to hear why this one works for you, if this one does work for you, when so clearly it does not for us. I'm glad I saw this movie is something mm-hmm. that I am going to say, because I really had always just sort of written it off as like another Adam Sandler romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more underneath the hood of this vehicle. Some of it's disgusting, and I don't want it in any of my newer model cars, but some of it does work. And I am excited to continue on this Adam and exploration. So that should be fun. Anything else that you want to say about Just Go With It before we send this one off? Or
No, I mean, like, you know, we didn't go into too many hard details because Box Office Mojo has been kind of back and forth about what you have access to and what you don't. There's now magically the ability to search weekends again like there wasn't a month ago or 2 months ago when we did our stuff. But so, like, just to put these out there, like, this isn't a movie that did poorly. Like, we're not just ripping apart a movie that nobody loved. Like, it for an $80 million film, clearly the entire budget went into them staying in Hawaii.
$20,000 a night at least.
But like, it ended up making like $300 million worldwide, so it's in that vein of Sandler doing you know, successful films. Like, it's not like it's a flop by any stretch. This is just before 2011 is easily in his workhorse mode, where he's doing like two or three films a year, three if you count like voice work and stuff like that, because this year he does Just Go With It and what's the other 2011 film? I mean, so the voice work is that he does the zookeeper. He ends up doing a few voices in that, most notably the monkey. Is this also the same year as Jack and Jill? Yep. Yeah, that's what it is. So, like, he's doing two movies a year now. 2014 is the year where he kind of probably overexerts himself. He does three movies of his own in addition to doing, like, three or four other projects that year. And just, like, so he ends up getting listed that year in more than half a dozen things. And, like, and so we're kind of on the verge of that, right? Like, so this is Sandler really in his like pushing it phase. So part of the other thing that's going on with this movie that maybe affects some of it is that, and the reason why maybe he wants to do one that's not solely a project that's like born from his own head, is he's just like, he's just doing anything and everything right now, you know. And he doesn't stop. Like, after 2014 he slows down a bit, but there's never a year where he's gone, you know.
That's an interesting point. I couldn't find proof that this is the first time that he works with Sony, but this is definitely one of the earliest films where Adam Sandler and Sony are in bed together, mm-hmm. With the product placement of the PlayStation 3. The kid's nanny plays a PSP Go, in addition to the fact that, you know, we also see in Pixels, that's very much Adam Sandler in bed with Sony, what with the PS4. And all of the other references to PlayStation properties. So it is interesting that looking at from a meta angle at to what Adam Sandler, the man, is doing, he is diversifying
heavily. He did his Disney dues a year or two previously with Bedtime Stories, right? Like, he's like, we've seen him start to kind of do that. This is after a year after he does the Judd Apatow Funny People project, which it felt like at that time, if you were going to be a comedian, you had to eventually work with Apatow, right? Yeah. So like, he is getting his hands into every possible pie that he possibly can. Yeah.
And then we see what that means going forward, especially when we look at something like Hubie Halloween, which reinvigorates and stokes the fires of a shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe. So, I mean, it's fun stuff. 2011 and Just Go With It, it's an important film in the career of Adam Sandler, even though it's not necessarily part of the cinematic universe that we're cultivating.
Mm-hmm.
And that is important. And I thank you for doing that. It was not number one, though, right? Did it win Valentine's Weekend?
No, because that is, hold on, I got Box Office Mojo right here. That is, unfortunately for them, and nothing was going to beat this, that is the same weekend Bieber's Never Say Never comes out. So it got its ass kicked by about $4 million at that point.
I mean, $4 million is not that bad, though. Let's just
It's
be
the difference
honest.
between a hit and double digits as far
That's,
as American.
I
Like,
mean,
it's an it only does
it's.
9.5 million, whereas like he was looking at some movies that were doing like 13, 14 million. And I mean, Bieber does 13 million that weekend. It comes just ahead of Romeo and Juliet, just to give you an idea of what else it was up against. No Strings Attached is still in theaters. It's in its 7th week, I think.
Yeah, about.
Yeah, so it's been out for a bit. Like, I mean, like in terms of other comedies that are out at that time, there's not too much. I mean, like Green Hornet, if you want to count that as one.
Well, I mean,
But I mean, like,
it's interesting when you consider Sandler and Rogen, and
yeah,
then
the year
Sandler and
previously.
Rogen in two films sort of
Yeah.
against each other.
But this is in terms of like romantic movies, if you really want to get into it, it's really interesting because this comes out in the dead season, you know, Valentine's February, after the Oscar bait of Blue Valentine, which was like kind of the movie that killed romance for a lot of people for a while. So it's also kind of like combating that kind of upswing, and like, and so in a weird way, it kind of becomes the movie that everybody needed in terms of like, a romantic movie after Blue Valentine. Like, we could really get into some heady conversations there. Oh man.
Yeah. And it's also, as much as like No Strings Attached is are two semi-established actors with Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher, right? It's sort of their what's next after the end of 70s Show and Natalie Portman being in, the Return of the Sith movies, the Star Wars movies, should
Yeah.
probably call them what they are. This is two names that these are household names that everybody knows.
Yeah,
So like,
Sandler and Aniston coming together to do a romantic comedy on your Valentine's Day. I mean, it's comfort food, right? Like, it really, really is.
unfortunately, I was uncomfortable pretty much the whole time.
Yeah.
Also, though, do you think Bailey Madison is named after Billy Madison? That was kind of hard to get out of my mind the whole time I was watching this film.
Oh dear God, no. Oh no, now I'm never gonna not think that. Oh yeah, the only last, and this is truly the last thing that I want to say on this, I will applaud the clearly Sandler-esque ability to work in a family story, and specifically his scenes with the kids. I think that of all of the irredeemable shit that's in this movie, the stuff that he does with the kids in this movie, and the stuff that have to do with him and Aniston and the kids in this movie, some of the best bits of the film, like,
Yeah,
hands down.
when he teaches Michael to swim, that is beautiful. That
That
whole subplot,
full on Sandler. Like,
I really enjoy the moment, and this is pretty much the only moment I had ever seen of this film, just on cable, is when he is with the two kids and Michael has just said, "It makes me sad when my dad doesn't make time for me," and Adam Sandler like, "Oh, that's not me. I'm not actually thinking that, but no, that's the role you're playing, you idiot." And he's just like, "We all have trauma, but like, keep it under wraps until we're back on the mainland." Like, and he's like, "You gotta be professionals." There was legitimately a thought in my mind before sitting down and paying attention to this movie that he had just like hired two child actors, that there was no connection to them at all. And it was just this kid's real trauma as a 6-year-old child actor coming out and him having to like manage it as just a guy. 'Cause I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know if they were con artists trying to take advantage of like a rich debutante. Like there was part of me that thought that Just Go With It might be a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh man, hells yes. Oh man.
Yeah, which is something to think about. Okay, so this has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. If you've enjoyed what we've talked about here, Sijin and I also do a weekly podcast called The Say Report, and in that show we talk about everything. So if you've liked our takes specifically about the Adam Sandler films and his cinematic universe, you'll probably also like our takes on a myriad of other topics, really just whatever comes to mind that week when we're recording. So check us out on the Say Report. And if you would like to get in touch with Seijin and share your thoughts about Just Go With It and how it might actually fit into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, how we're just completely wrong with our cartography related to it, he's on Twitter at Siege Versus the World.
And if you want to film yourself doing an impression of Nick Swartzen doing an impression of a German professor, you can hit Devin up at Devin D. Decker.
Yes, I would love to see it. That is something that I would make me very happy as a sheep shipper. It would be sheep 9. My God, we did not talk at all about Nick Swartzen. And
we avoided it after we talked about how fucking weird his character was.
So fucking weird. And that's where we're still going to leave it. So thank you very much for joining us in this plunge into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And until next time, remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a great day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.